So, Peter, thanks for taking the time today to talk with us about a few of these stories that you've been working on. It definitely isn't one of these big, flashy environmental stories. The Seneca Cuca Nine Element Plan is attempting to tackle phosphorus, I believe, runoff into the watershed there between the two lakes. So give us kind of a 101 level overview of what this plan means and the possible impact of it.
Sure. Okay. Well, it's called, the jargon name is the Nine Element Plan, and it's because of nine very steps that they want to take. It's a template that was formed, I think, by the EPA originally, and other lakes are doing the same thing. Everybody's doing their Nine Element Plans. One of the reasons for doing these is to facilitate getting grants, federal and state grants. Once you have this in place, it puts you in a stronger position to apply for and obtain grants to do some of these steps that they're talking about doing that would help reduce phosphorus. And again, what's driving this, in my sense, is the explosion of HABs, of toxic cyanobacteria blooms. They call them HABs, harmful algal blooms. That's what's targeting it. That's what's driving it. And Cayuga has done it. Owasco has done it. Honey Eye. Several others have already completed theirs. And so the DEC recently approved the Seneca Cuca 9E plan. And it is attempting to reduce phosphorus in order to try to tackle this really, really big problem of HABs, of the toxic blooms, because that is potentially going to interfere with the drinking water that a lot of people rely on. And even before that, it's going to affect the recreation on the lake. In other, you can't swim in a toxic bloom. It's a real threat to your dog. If your dog goes in the water and comes out and licks itself, it can be very, very serious, even fatal. So it's a big, big problem for the Finger Lakes. So they're trying to identify ways to reduce phosphorus because they have determined that phosphorus is the primary driver of HABs. Now, there are other causes. The causes of HABs are very complex. They're not totally understood, but everybody understands that phosphorus is one of the really, really important parts of it.
And what were the big takeaways in terms of, the actionable steps that will be taken through this plan? And how exactly does that happen on sort of the ground level? It seems like there's a pretty, at least to the layman, it seems like there's a pretty significant component that involves working with farmers and ag to try and correct runoff issues. How exactly does that happen?
Well, there's a very interesting statistic here. I have to look at my paper here to get it exactly right. But they determined through their modeling that that 46% of this Seneca Cuca watershed, which is an area around the two lakes that flow into the two lakes, 46% of that acreage of that watershed is either cultivated crops or hay and pasture. So generally speaking, it's farmland. Yeah. That 46% of the acreage is creating 70% of the phosphorus. In contrast, if you look at the forest lands, the wetlands, scrub vegetation, that's 45% of the acreage. That's only contributing 10%. So that's 10%. So 45% of the acreage is contributing 10%. And then 46% is contributing 70%. And that's why farmland is sort of getting identified as the main problem here. Now, in the past, people have made an issue about the wastewater treatment plants, maybe even vineyards, maybe septic tanks on the lake. But it's interesting, septic tanks were found to be only 1% of the problem. Wineries, the whole vineyards and all that, that's only 2%. And even the wastewater treatment plants and and other facilities that have discharge permits, they're only 11%. So the farmers seem to be, you know, the main cause of this. Now, dealing with it is a very touchy political issue because farmers, you know, they have a right to exist. We need them in the area. But is there a way that we can somehow mitigate the damage that's being caused to the lakes? That's the question. And it's a touchy political thing. This document is not a political document, the 9E document. It's very, it's very data oriented, but it's not political. It's not hammering home a point, oh, we need to go after the farmers, or far be it. In fact, almost the opposite. It's very gentle on the farmers. And I see they have an implementation problem or plan. And it's not particularly ambitious. They realize that it's a very, very difficult issue to deal with. Well, I should also say another big part of this is that while they're trying to reduce phosphorus, they've also got to deal with the fact that we have climate change. And they see that climate change, even as we make improvements on farming practices and things like that, climate change is going to hurt us in the other direction. It's going to make it more difficult because we're going to have more big rain events that are going to, you know, pour water into these tributaries and just bring a lot of new phosphorus into the lakes. So that's what you're working against. So it's a real challenge. I see that they have implementation goals, but in the first 1 to 5 years, they only expect to get 25% of the way toward meeting those goals. In the next, 5 to 10 years, they'll get to 50%. And in 10 to 20 years, they'll get to 100% of what they want to do. But it's really interesting what their goals are. Their goals are actually very modest. Even at 100%, you're not really reducing the phosphorus very much because you're working against the climate problem the whole time, this huge runoff problem that's going to become more and more intense. So even if you do a lot of the steps that they're advocating, you're still working against the problem of increasing runoff.
What has the response been like from the folks who are on the front lines of this, especially on the Habs fight every summer and every fall? What has the response been to the plan between the watershed or between the two lakes? Excuse me.
Well, this has all happened pretty quietly. It's you have some very hardworking people who've been putting this together for really a couple of years, and there's some local people who've been involved. Mark Venuti's been involved, and Ian Smith, who is the Seneca Watershed Manager, people like that have been involved for a long time on this. There's been very little public response to what's going on here. This has all been done kind of quietly. It's not, it's not a very political document. So it's been pretty under the radar. One suggestion that they have that for the farmers, that seems to come out in the report to stand out is to plant cover crops in the winter. There's one sentence in the report that really struck me. Now, let me see if I can even read it to you here. It says here, by planting winter wheat on land classified as row crops, and then harvesting it in mid-April, farms could reduce the total phosphorus load of the entire watershed by an estimated 20%. And individual watersheds could see phosphorus cuts that exceed 40%. Well, those are huge numbers. Those are way beyond even the you know, what the goals are. I mean, if you could do that, it would make a tremendous impact. But I don't really know what expenses involved for the farmers. I think if we're going to make the farmers do things, there's going to have to be state funding to help it happen. You can't just say to the farmers, well, you need to clean up your act and you need to pay for it. No, the state's going to have to pay for it, or you know, they're going to need to get funding to allow that to happen. And I think that's what needs to happen.
We're getting toward the end of what is the typical HAB season. You report on HABs throughout the summer and into the fall. What was your impression, or what's your takeaway been from the 2022 HAB season?
The lakes that have had the most problems, Cayuga and Owasco, these were, again, very rough years for them. Seneca, Seneca had, you know, plenty of HABs events, but it was a, I would say, more of a moderate year. We are seeing a real trend of this happening, particularly on Seneca, late in the summer. It doesn't really start in July. In fact, I think Seneca Lake Pure Waters doesn't even really start actively monitoring until, I think, August 1st. I think that's right. And what we see is they start building in August, and then September seems to be the peak month, although there continue to be HABs in October. I know Owasco had a group of them in mid-October. So even when we're out of the summer, the water is still warm enough and the conditions are ripe for there to continue to be HABs all the way probably almost to the end of October.
I was going to say, especially when you got 70 plus degrees on tap for the first week of November in upstate New York.
Yeah.
Obviously, your reporting on Greenwich has been some of the most thorough in the Finger Lakes, probably the most thorough in the Finger Lakes. Where do we stand right now with Greenwich Generation, their operation in Dresden, and recent DEC decisions about what they can and can't do?
Right. Well, I think one of the important things to keep in mind is that a lot of the reporting has suggested that they have a lot of you know, regulatory issues that could hamper their operation or their growth. And I don't really see it that way. I see the regulatory impediments as actually very something that the company can easily overcome, whereas the real impediment is their financial condition. And, it's a financial condition that is, if anything, going to slow down the operation, in my opinion. I think that what's significant, and this is reflected in their stock price, you can see it has really, really tailed off. It's certainly fallen more than 90% in a year. It's in recent days traded under $1, and it's traded on the NASDAQ exchange. And NASDAQ has rules about stocks that trade under $1. If you do it for 30 days in a row, they can actually force you to delist your stock. Now, Greenwich is not in that state right now, but it could fall to that if they have problems meeting their debt payments. The problem is that they borrowed very heavily at very high interest rates to buy a lot of the latest Bitcoin mining equipment, because they're in an arms race with other Bitcoin miners around the world. They have to have the best equipment if they're going to mine Bitcoin. So they've done that. They've committed. They're kind of all in on that. But the problem is they had to borrow at very high rates, so they have a big, big debt overhang. And then they sort of got slammed by the fact that Bitcoin, the price of a Bitcoin has fallen, you know, it's basically half what it was in April. And that has really, really hurt their cash flow. So that's what they're really fighting. Now, as for the regulatory side of it, yes, they have issues with their air permit, with their water permit. But those are things that they can manage, given that the Hochul administration, like the Cuomo administration, has been extraordinarily accommodating. If there's a deadline, well, a deadline can always be moved and always is. And so the air permit, for example, I mean, the air permit that they're operating under right now was issued in 2017. And it expired in September. The company had applied to renew it 6 months before that. But the DEC, on June 30th, they denied it. They said, we're not going to renew it. After many delays, they finally got around to doing that. At this point, Greenwich had really three options. It could either shut down, it could sue in court, in state court, or it could go to the DEC and say, we want an internal review of your decision to deny us the air permit. And so that's the option that Greenwich took. The DEC at that point had two choices. They could either accept that, or they could say, no, you know, we're confident in our decision. You'll have to take it to court. They didn't do that. They said, yes, we'll do the internal review. Well, those internal reviews are fairly notorious for taking forever. And the company is allowed to operate as long as that is pending. So they basically have no issue in terms of operating, continuing their Bitcoin mining operation. They can continue to do that as long as this goes on, and it will go on for a long time. Now, the other part of it is the water permit. And the water permit has to do with the screens on the coolant water intake pipe. And the DEC had allowed the company to start operating back in 2017, early 2017, without a water permit at all, without an updated one. They finally got around to granting the updated water permit later in 2017. And that permit said, you have to install fish screens on your water intake pipe in Seneca Lake. And the deadline for installing those was the expiration date of the water permit. And they didn't get it done. And so now they've been given another extension. And I would predict that they're not going to make this deadline either, and they'll get another extension. That's what I would expect.
Is it that ambiguous with a lot of these state processes that involve either application or permit renewals or reviews? Is it common for the terms and conditions and as far as timeline is concerned to be as ambiguous as it seems with Greenwich?
Well, there's a state regulation that allows the DEC to just roll over these permits. And they're called, you know, some people who don't like them call them zombie permits, because the rule says that you have a permit deadline staring you in the face. All you have to do is apply and have your application accepted, and then it doesn't matter. The termination date, the expiration date of that permit doesn't mean a thing. And the companies all know this. It's a concession to the companies. And one of the advocates has suggested that what the DEC could do, they could go to the state legislature and say, we really need to tighten up that law, because our permit regulations are so soft that they become meaningless. And I don't expect the DEC to do that, though, because it accommodates the DEC, too. It makes it easier for them.
Are you surprised at all, covering this day in and day out, week in and week out, and it's been a while now, how much of a business story this has evolved into compared to some of the other environmental stories or issues that have?
Well, when you scratch the surface, all of these issues are they're financial, they're legal, and they're political. They're all three of those. I mean, the big ones are anyway. And so it's not doesn't surprise me at all. The reason Atlas came in and bought Greenwich was it was a business opportunity. They're looking to make money. And obviously that has a political dimension to it, and obviously financial and legal.
What is the biggest unknown right now for the community at large when it comes to the future of Greenwich and where it's going?
Well, that's a good question, because you know, the recent resignation of the CEO, Jeff Kurt, came as a surprise to all of us in the area, I think. And almost as surprising as who they brought in to replace him. They brought in a CEO and another person, maybe someone who would be a chief operating officer, I'm not sure what, but they came from a forest products company in Canada. And they have, as far as I know, Greenidge has not said anything about their experience with Bitcoin or with operating a power plant. So we really don't know if they plan some kind of a change in their business operation. You know, who knows? They may have something planned that we can't see at this point. So we'll just have to wait and see. But I think the transition of management is significant. Mm-hmm. We just don't know enough to know where it's going to take us.
Appreciate the time. Thanks so much for taking it today to talk with us.
Absolutely.